Good to be anywhere sober. Welcome to the newcomers. If you're new, I'm glad you're here. I don't know how you feel about it, but there's some people that have been here for a little while that are really glad you're here. And visitors, glad you're here too. I'm really grateful to be back here in the Coachella Valley. In spite of the heat, it's really good to see you guys. I have a lot of peers and men and women that have been a part of my sobriety for a lot of years. I got sober out here. I got dropped off at the ABC Club somewhere on or about August 27th, 1993. And I made this my home for a lot of years. And I'm living in Costa Mesa now, and it's beautiful. It's a big change. I was born and raised in Orange County. And going back has been kind of a long, full circle. It took about 18 and a half years in between for me to end up back in Orange County. Anyways, I'm a little anxious, I'm not going to lie. I think I overshot the mark at the Coffee Bean before this meeting. I stopped over there, and I'm not sure. I think my friend Johnny had him put something in it. Whew, man, I'm buzzed. I got freaking cottonmouth, Frank. I swear to God. Jeez. You know, I always see double, but it's bad right now. there's men in this room, and I'm not sure if there's any women, but there's men in this room that I got sober with, that I was actually in treatment with. I actually talked to one of those guys today, and you know what's interesting is there's actually a fair amount of people that I was in treatment with at the ABC Club in the class of 93 and 94 when I was there that are actually still sober. It's amazing. I think the percentage is pretty high. I got to tell you, I know of at least five or six people that are in their 20th year of sobriety right now I don't know, 80 people. I think that's pretty good odds compared to what I've seen over the past 20 years of my sobriety. That's a good chunk of people that stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there may even be more than that because, you know, we come and go. I got to tell you, I have a sponsor. His name is Jack C. He lives in Newport Beach. And I met him at a men's stag. Out there I was looking to connect, and I liked what he had to say, and he's not my first sponsor by any means. I think he's probably my fourth sponsor since I've been sober. And my home group is the 6:30 a.m. roundtable discussion meeting at the Newport Alano Club, and I go there 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And I just recently, after living out there for a little bit over a year and a half, just established, I found my home group finally. It took me a little while. I don't know, I just want to talk to the newcomers before I really get into this story. And I just want to say, I don't know what it is that brought you here. I don't know what it is that, I take that back. I know what it was that brought you here. Alcoholism is what brought you here. I'm not sure what it is that's going to cause you to leave. Okay, I don't know what it is that's going to run you out of here, but I know alcoholism will bring you back, you know, if you're lucky. And I'm one of those guys that, I came here with zero motivation to be sober. I had no intentions of getting sober when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was simply trying to appease the courts. You know, I'm one of those that, some of you people that came here before me have gotten to see. I don't know. You know, everybody comes here for different reasons, whether it's legal, financial, you know, maybe your boss telling you to either do something about it, your relationships, or whatever, you know. And I know that a lot of people come here for different reasons. But there's only one reason that I've seen people stay. And that reason is they actually are active in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've seen a lot of people that can hang around Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you've been here for any length of time, you'll see what I was taught and referred to as the passing parade of people that come in Alcoholics Anonymous and don't stick, and they just kind of go on, or they'll do that roundabout thing where they'll keep coming back. And that's it's difficult for me to watch as people come in and out, I never like to say this with any arrogance or any type of, you know, cockiness, but I got sober the first time I tried to get sober, and I want to tell you, I did that in spite of myself. Because I got to tell you, my intentions were not to stay sober. My intention was just to get the heat off and appease the courts. Because one more time, I had gotten in trouble, and I was looking at some jail time, and they gave me a sentence to a treatment program in lieu of a prison sentence, which I'm really grateful for. At the time, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I just knew that I didn't want to go to jail, and I had to do what I had to do because I had done what I always done, which is push it right to the end and get backed into a corner to where I don't have any choice. If you're one of those people that, you know, waited to the very last minute to get here, welcome. You know, that's kind of the deal. Unlike anybody else, I don't know about you, but I didn't get here on a winning streak. You know, things were not looking too good. The fact of the matter is that I'm standing up here living proof that you don't have to want this thing to get sober when you get here. So if you're sitting there thinking to yourself, you know what, I'm not here for the right reasons, or I'm here for the wrong reasons, or, you know, that person's here for the right reasons, or if you're thinking, you know what, I came here on my own, like that's going to give you a better chance at staying sober. I got bad news for you. Because what it is that gets you here has nothing to do with whether or not you stay here. It's what you do once you get here that has everything to do with whether or not you're going to stay here. When I got dropped off at the ABC Club, I was told really quickly what to do and when to do it, and I needed that. That's one of the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you'll show up here and submit yourself to this deal, we'll tell you what to do. The good news is it will work. I have seen it time and time and time again. I've been a watcher my whole life. I watch what's going on around me. It's what I've done to protect myself and take care of myself and survive. I watch what's going on because I need to know, you know, who's a threat, who's a lame and all that other stuff, who's weak, who's crazy, and who could probably kick my ass. Those are important things to know in life. And I've been watching, and I swear, I'm looking around at a lot of people do not stay here. They come in and they go. I really have tried to figure out what is it that they all have in common. The people that don't stay, you know, the whatever you call the relapsers, you know, there's lots of different terms. But the one thing that I've determined, you know, that they all have in common is that they somehow convince themselves that they don't have to do what we're doing to stay sober, that they're somehow unique and different, and they're going to look at the steps and try to alter them to suit themselves, and or they're going to decline to do a certain part of it because they don't want to. Or they're afraid. I don't think it's any mistake that fear is a big part of our inventory that we do. And it talks about 100 forms of fear and all that stuff that's the root of our problem. And, you know, there's a lot going on there. I'm a pretty basic person, you know. I'm selfish and self-centered. And, you know, when I was young, I struggled. You know, it's a sad story. I mean, I could really cry right now telling you my story about my childhood. It sucked bad. I was an only child, you know. Don't start that crap. But I was an only child raised by a single parent, and that was because my mom had bailed and my parents divorced when I was 5 years old. And that hurt. That hurt a lot because as a 5 and 6 year old kid, by the time I was 9 years old, I had thought about it enough and twisted around and convinced myself that it was probably my fault that mom and dad split up. And it was probably my fault that mom never made any effort to find me or get in touch with me. And I felt less, I swear, man, I had so much fear of inadequacy and all that stuff. I don't want to get all psychodramatic on you. But, you know, these are some of the flaws in my makeup that the big book talks about that caused my failure. Okay. I absolutely felt worthless. And, you know, to add on to it, you know, I had this stepmom that came into the picture when I was about 9 years old. And she was an absolute maniac. And I think I played a part in that. You know, I think I really played a part in driving her crazy and pushing her buttons. I don't know about you, but I'm a button pusher. And, you know, so she was insane, and I was a smart ass. And I would push her buttons, and she would flip out. She was real shaming. And I was already, you know, screwed up. I had, you know, this eye problems and stuff. I was a bedwetter till I was 8 years old. And I didn't talk about that a lot before I got here, I can tell you that. I wasn't offering up that information in circles this big, that's for sure. Or the fellows at Orange County Jail. Yeah, I was a bedwetter. Not happening. But you know what she would do is she would shame the crap out of me. I mean, she was just horrible. She was just so abusive and hostile and all this other stuff. And I actually have some of those traits, you know. I'm not going to lie. Seriously, I was programmed really well for that growing up. And I was programmed for a lot of stuff growing up from my dad and my stepmom and the neighborhood and the fellas and all that other stuff. Anyways, I was born partially sighted. I got a wonky eye. I got a lazy eye. It kind of wanders off. And if you're ever not sure if I'm talking to you, it's okay to say, Patrick, are you talking to me right now? I don't take it personal. I really don't, because it's so subconscious. It just kind of has a mind of its own. It tends to want to look at the North Star no matter which way I'm facing. It just naturally goes right to the North Star. Anyways, I got these eye problems, and I was partially sighted and all this other stuff. And you know what? I just want to tell you one of the most painful memories I have as a child. And I'm smiling while saying it, which is fairly twisted. I'm not going to lie. But, you know, so when my parents divorced, between the time when my mom left and my stepmom came in the picture, it was just me and my pop. And my pop was a fireman. And as a fireman, he worked these shifts that were 24 on, 24 off. And so he would go, and he'd be gone for a day, and I used to be absolutely terrified that he would not return. I thought he would pull a number like my mom did. And whenever I'd see my dad in his uniform, and my dad was a big strapping guy, good-sized guy like me, cowboy, very, very mild-mannered, cool-headed, respectful gentleman, looked a little bit like John Wayne, you know, had big, huge hands, taught me how to shake a man's hand. And I'll never forget that kind of stuff my dad taught me. But he would come out in his uniform, his fireman's uniform, and I would immediately be ridden with anxiety and fear because I knew what he was going to do. He was going to get in his truck, and he was going to split, and he was going to go to work. And my fear was that he wouldn't come back, and I would follow my dad out into the driveway, and I would be in the driveway begging and pleading with him, Dad, please don't go. And he would have to go. And that was a recurring thing for me. Of every other day seeing that type of stuff go on. I can tell you countless times standing in that driveway, you know, really emotional. I mean, just begging and pleading and tearing, you know. And, you know, at some point, those emotions got shut off. And I didn't allow myself to feel like that anymore. I wouldn't do it. And alcohol and other substances, what we might refer to as outside issues, played a big part in that, with turning off those emotions. And I found those fairly early on, about 11 years old. I got involved with the Boy Scouts. And what? It was fun. Yeah, you know, the Boy Scouts were a blast. I found cigarettes, you know, nicotine. I found nicotine in the Boy Scouts and no-dos. No Dose was one of my favorites, and I also found a little bit of tequila in there, And I got introduced to alcohol fairly young, and I didn't like the way it tasted or anything like that. But it was like something that kids weren't supposed to have, so I immediately wanted it. Anyways, you know, so my introduction to changing the way I feel started pretty young. And I was a rager when I was a kid. I would just snap, and I like to throw stuff. When I would get angry, I would just pick up whatever it is and I would throw it. And people hit, you know, a couple people got hurt because of that. I mean, I hit one kid with a trash can, and in fourth grade, in Mrs. Bird's class, metal one, I crashed him over the head really big. He made some comment and just smashed him in the head. And I felt pretty good about that at the time. I really did. I felt that was kind of cool to smash the crap out of his head. Because he hurt my feelings, he pissed me off, and see, I didn't really want, I couldn't show a lot of fear or hurt, but I could show anger. That was fairly acceptable culturally, you know. Anyway, so I did that stuff, and I hid a lot. I spent a lot of time alone, and then I wasn't. I started to grow up, and I became this really social guy that could walk up to just about anybody and talk to them, and I did that a lot. I got moved around to a lot of schools and stuff like that. That was difficult. And but as I started to get older, I just I found Jack Daniels at Smith's Food King on the shelf, and I could steal it and get away with it. And that's what I did. I would steal Jack Daniels every chance that I got. And once I got enough Jack Daniels in me, I could go back to Smith's Food King and steal a carton of cigarettes and hand them out to the other kids. They really liked that. You know, I was pretty cool for doing that. Anyway, so, you know, I really gravitated away from my dad because he went more into his work, and my stepmom was out of the picture, and I didn't have any parenting going on in my formidable years, my adolescence. I had no guidance or anything like that. I really went out into the neighborhood and into the streets, you know, the cold, hardcore streets of Westminster. And dropped out of school, lost interest in that. And started to just party. That was my job. That's all I freaking did, was party. My dad used to call me Good Time Charlie, because that's really all I, nothing, no offense, Charlie. All right. But that's what he called me, Good Time Charlie, because that's all I cared about, was having a good time. And I would go to absurd lengths to have a good time. Absurd lengths. And you know, that was all good, I guess, for a little while. My dad wasn't tripping. You know, I wasn't really getting in a lot of trouble. No real trouble. I wasn't involved with youth authority or anything like that. I don't want to mess up the time. There we go. Okay. And I didn't get, you know, none of that stuff. I got some traffic tickets, you know. I like to ride a motorcycle around. And I like to do wheelies on my motorcycle. And I would get tickets, and the only problem was is I wouldn't go to court or pay any fines. And when you don't go to court or pay any fines, they put warrants out for your arrest. I learned that. And when they catch you, they will freaking arrest you and put you right in jail. And that happened to me a lot. That was kind of a recurring theme for me, was I would get a ticket, and I would they would say, you know, sign right here on the line, and this is your court date, and promise to appear. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll be there. And then I wouldn't show up, and I'd get a warrant for my arrest, and I'd, Good Time Charlie's out ripping and running around the neighborhood until he gets pulled over again for doing something stupid. And then they would find this warrant, and they would take me to jail. And that's kind of where it started for me. I got a really good education in Orange County Jail on how to behave with other men, stay out of trouble, or get in trouble, one of the two, whatever you want. And so I did that, and you know, I'm a hard-headed, self-willed, really immature kid. You know, that's all I was. And I was that when I got sober at 27 years old. That I was still that. That's who I was. I hadn't during that whole time. I just hadn't grown up. I was in my perpetual adolescence. I was completely stuck there. And, you know, there's so many people that had gone on and moved. I didn't hang out with them, but I heard about these people that had gotten jobs and went to school and all this other stuff. I didn't know any of them. But I heard a lot about them, and I was compared to them a lot. But these people that were able to grow up and do what they needed to do and build their lives. And it was a little bit of a tough deal for me coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, being a young guy. 20 years ago, there weren't too many of us that were 27 years old. That was fairly young. I know that it was definitely the exception, and now it seems to be the rule. And that's okay. You know, it is what it is. You know, we're still here. And, you know, so when I got here, I was surrounded by a bunch of people that had lives and had really some real consequences as a result of their alcoholism. I had never really lost anything except my freedom, and that was a fair price for me to pay. I was okay with it. Because one thing I learned about myself through doing inventory and listening to you folks and relating is I'm just the king of lowering my standards. If I get any amount of time to actually think about it and lower my standards to accept the insanity of my life as normal, I'll do it. You know, I heard a speaker refer to it. Everybody, he says, every bottom I've ever hit is when circumstances around me happen faster than I could lower my standards. I was like, whoa, that's my freaking life right there. I'm the king of lowering my standards. Anyway, so I did a lot of that. I did a lot of lowering my standards and accepting the insanity and outright laziness and lack of motivation to do or become anything as acceptable. And that must have been difficult for you older folks that were here, seeing a knucklehead like me come in here, you know. Because what's interesting is in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to recreate, or actually not even recreate, but create a life. I just ripped and ran and did my deal and got in trouble and in and out of jail and homeless, absolutely. Have lived in a carport, abandoned van in somebody's backyard. I've lived in a couple of cars. I lived in a car with another guy and his dog. That sucks. And, I mean, it was a Sheltie. I hated that dog. He shed it everywhere. I'm a little OCD. I don't like hair. That was a nightmare. Anyways, I just continued to lower my standards and lower my standards to where it was entirely normal for me to live in a car for a year. I would much rather do that than be responsible and do what everybody else was doing that was a grown up and have a life. So, you know, that was my norm. And, you know, so as a result of my continued non-compliance and irresponsibility with the courts, I ended up doing a fair amount of county jail time behind that on the installment plan, just a stupid amount of time, going in and out of Orange County branch jails, Theo Lacy and James A. Music, you know, a place they call the farm, and I was a local there and knew the deputies by name, and they knew me. Hey, Smith, what's up? Welcome back. Yeah, stupid. But that was my life, and it was acceptable. You know, I lowered my standards enough to believe that was okay. Anyways, my bottom, I had no idea was going to be my bottom. I think that it could have gotten a lot worse. But today I believe that, you know, my higher power helped that be my bottom. And like I said, I was completely clueless. But, you know, I get teased a little bit because part of my story is, you know, about losing one of my shoes. And, you know, I was up in Big Bear after getting released from Orange County Jail. I met this hippie dude in jail there. And he's like, he's looking at me and he goes, man, you're messed up. Where have you been? I'm like, yeah, I'm in Midway City. And he goes, where's that? I said, it's in Orange County. And I'm just down First Street turns into Bolsa. It's between Huntington Beach and Westminster. And he says, well, what do you do there? burn my life to the ground. Pretty much, that was it. Live in a van? Stupid. Yeah. Place called Hinky Corner is where I was living. And, you know, I guess if you're living in Hinky Corner, David, you're probably a little hinky. Yeah. I was a little hinky. Anyways, so, you know, I told him about this place. Man, he's like, man, you need to get the hell out of there. Come on up to Big Bear. It's God's country, bro, dude. You know, you know, freaking tie-dye shirt on or whatever. I don't know. He was wearing a jumpsuit when I met him. Anyway, anyway, so he says, yeah, give me a call when you get released. We'll come up to Big Bear and Scott's Country. I'm like, okay, that sounds cool. So I got released and I walked out of, you know, the Orange County jail, and I had my little expando folder, which you can tell anybody in Orange County that's getting released from jail. They got this folder that you have and keep your whole life in. That was my life. It's this little ridiculous folder. And I was in pants that didn't even come close to fitting me anymore because I got arrested. I was 160. I got out. I was 220. I swear to God, there was no such thing as skinny jeans, but that's what I had going. I was sporting some super skinny jeans. They were tight. I swear to God, I couldn't even move the zipper up. Just out. And I did that. I just would get arrested, and I would go. And then I'd get out, and I'd go. I did this. It might explain this. I don't know. But I got released in these clothes that didn't fit anymore, and I called him up, and the dude came and picked me up in this 1956 freaking steak bed tie-dye pickup with a peace flag on it. It was ridiculous. I'd never heard the Grateful Dead in my life, and all this, you know, hell in a bucket, you know, hauling ass up the mountain, you know, this dude's wasted out of his head, and I'm like, yeah, this is great. I was ready to die. I had no idea. Anyways, he was doing a lot of LSD. Could be a trick picking this up right now, I'm telling you. They said grow or go, David. Yep. So this guy picked me up. I went up there to Big Bear and proceeded to not do anything. you know, all I needed was to go look for a job. I wouldn't do that. That's stupid. Why would I do that? Look for a job. Anyway, so I went up there and completely did exactly what I'd always done. I was just a loser up there. You know, the loser got out of jail and went to Big Bear is all that changed. And so I got up there, and pretty soon he got tired of me being a loser, and he said, you know what, it's time for you to go. You caught me doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing, and said, you got to go. So I said, okay, see you later. And I had I'd been on a sick one for a little bit. I was in a little bit of a binge, you might say. And so I proceeded to walk out into the mountains, Big Bear, a lot of trees up there, pine needles and stuff like that. And I'm from Westminster. I'm not like a woodsy guy at the time, to say the least. Wasn't you know, canyon man running around the mountain up there. But I wandered around for a little while, a few days. I think wandered around up there, lost my mind, and completely lost my mind. I was talking to trees and asking for cigarettes, fun stuff like that. Got chased by the same dog twice that night. Swear to God, I went in this guy's backyard, was drinking from his hose, petting a dog, like it's a thing to do. You know, I was thirsty, man. Okay, gotta go later. I'm cool. I got enough water. Dog's cool. Evidently, he didn't want me to leave. Or maybe he did. So he chased my butt out of there, came after me, and I got away. And I was so out of my mind, I walked in a circle, ended up in the same backyard. That's step one, baby. I swear to God, you get chased by the same dog twice in one night, you're an alcoholic, I guarantee it. Or if you run out of gas twice in the same day, you're an alcoholic. I've done that one. Anyway, so this dog chased me and all that stuff, and I climbed this mountain, and partway up the mountain, I lost one of my shoes. Bush grabbed it, and I asked my imaginary friend to get it, and he refused, evidently. So I kept going without my shoe. Anyways, don't walk around the frickin' forest with one shoe on. It hurts. After a while, it starts to hurt. Anyway, so it's just insanity and stupidity. And next thing you know, I'm getting woken up by a Bear Valley sheriff. I got off the mountain. I was in somebody's front yard in this beautiful piece of grass. Very comfortable piece of grass. I was really tired. Very, very comfortable piece of grass. And I'm getting woke up by this Bear Valley sheriff. And he's like kicking me. He's all, hey, where's your other shoe? And, I said, it's up on the mountain. And he goes, what are you doing here? Resting. And he goes, do you have anything you're not supposed to have on you, any weapons and blah, blah, blah? And I said, yes, because I did. And I played with the cops before, so I'm not one to lie, and I'm not going to have a shootout or anything stupid like that. I'm going to jail, and I know I'm going to jail, so I'm just going to kind of make it easy on myself. And so I just didn't have it in me anymore, and I didn't fight, so I went to jail and told them what I was doing up there and all that good stuff. And they promptly charged me with a felony, and that still sticks with me to this day. I proudly carry that. No, it's not proudly. But I don't have to do traffic or jury duty. I'm completely free of that.
Amen.
Yeah. No more jury duty for this guy. So I'm optimistic about it, I guess. Anyway, so I went to jail, and I ended up, one more time, having to call my dad, who had gotten smart. My dad was not that dumb. He retired from the fire department and left this frickin' state, went to Oklahoma and built a life away from me, which was smart. And I called up my pop, and I had to tell him, Dad, I'm in big trouble, and I was broken. Literally, I was broken, and I was just completely devastated. I'd burned my life to the ground. I had nothing. Absolutely worthless life that I had. I was just existing, and I wasn't contributing anything to anybody ever. I was just constantly on the take. It's disgusting, And I asked my dad for help, and he helped me. My dad has always loved me, and he's always helped me out. And we got an attorney, and I got one heck of a deal, man. I was offered treatment instead of prison, and I took it. I called up a family friend and asked for help, and went to their place, and they one thing led to another. They hooked me up with another guy. His name was Joe, and he was a detox manager at the ABC Club. I didn't know it, but he was a friend of my family's, and I'd never met him before. And he came and talked to me, and he asked me these ridiculous questions that I didn't have the answer for, like, "What's your frickin' problem, dude?" That's a tough question. When you're as screwed up as I was, I had no idea what my problem was. And he said, "I know what your problem is. You don't know how to live," is what he told me. And I was completely blown away by that. So couldn't argue with the guy. And one thing led to another. And this man ended up bringing me out here and taking me to the ABC Club in beautiful Indio, California, in the middle of August. And it was hot, to say the least. And I got introduced to some folks there, and he walked me in and said, this is Teresa, and make sure he's in the 7 a.m. meeting in the morning. And I went into detox, and I stayed in detox for 5 days. And when the time was up, they were saying, "Okay, you got to go." And I thought I was staying, so I got scared, and I started to flip out a little bit. And they said, "Okay, hold on." I said, "I need to talk to Joe." And And I called Joe, and he said, well, don't trip, man. He goes, I'll be there. And he showed up, and he went in and told Danny that I was his nephew. And can you keep him? And Danny said, yeah. He must have known he was lying. Joe's an Indian this tall. Yeah. Anyway, so I stayed, and they moved me out of detox up into the floor of the TV room, and I worked my way up to a couch, and they gave me these chores to do, and they brought me in the mix, and they told me what I was going to do and what I wasn't going to do, and I did that imperfectly. You know, I had a bad attitude. I was a smart ass. I was verbally abusive. I brought all that stuff into the ABC Club with me, and had no idea I was getting sober. I just thought I was just going to do the 6 months in that place, fly under the radar, get out and do what I wanted to do. It's what I always did. And I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I just, you know, knew that I had to do this. And a lot of times I can step up when I don't have any choice, and I wasn't given much of a choice at that time, because I had these external motivators, which really I think was a blessing for me. So I started doing what they told me to do after being threatened, you know, because they would say, you know, Patrick, we need you to make your bed and stuff like that. But if you don't want to, you know, it's cool. You don't have to make your bed if you don't want to. You can always pack your shit and get the hell out of here, you know. And I heard that a lot. We used to have a meeting on Tuesday nights called the Pack Your Shit Meeting, you know. A lot of people pack their shit at that place, okay. I'll never forget the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. I'm sitting at the table eating my lunch, you know, free lunch. I didn't pay for anything. I'm sitting there, and Danny walks in and starts pointing. He goes, you, and you, pointing out like six people, and says, you guys think you can run around on the weekend and screw each other and nobody's going to find out about it? Why don't you guys help your little girlfriends pack their shit and all you get the hell out of my house? Just threw them all out. I was like frozen. Oh, my God. I knew I was next, man. That guy was going to throw me out, and he did not put up with any crap. And, you know, I did what I was told to do. After a while, I got to a point, and they said, you know, finally said, you know, Patrick, do you have a sponsor? I'm like, no, I don't have a sponsor. They said, well, you need to get a sponsor. Or, you know, you really don't have to if you don't want to. You can always pack your shit and get the hell out of here. So I got a sponsor. Got this guy, Bob. Scottish Bob, yeah. And me and Bob didn't have a lot in common. You know, and I've heard in AA, you know, that, you know, you should find a sponsor that can you can really relate with, and you have similar stories and all that stuff. Well, I'm here to tell you that's not the case. This guy didn't live the life I lived. He lived a much different life. The only thing we had in common is we had both burned our lives to the ground, evidently. And he knew what I was going through, and he was just willing enough to spend enough time with a knucklehead like me, in spite of all my wonderful character defects. This guy would sit down with me, and we would talk, and he gave me some stuff to do, and he says, you know what, you need to get a big book. And I'm like, well, how do I get one? And he said, go ask Danny for one. And Daddy said, go wash my car, asshole, I ain't giving you nothing. And I said, okay. So I went and washed his car, and he gave me a big book. And then my sponsor said, you need a 12 and 12. And I was like, okay, I know how to get one of those, because somebody had just shared in the meeting that day, if you can't afford a book, steal one. I was like, yes, I get to steal. I got the green light. So somebody left a 12 and 12 sitting out, and they had their name on the front page. And it's amazing. As soon as I tore that frickin' page out of there, it became my book. So I ended up with a free 12 and 12 and read the step, you know, because he would tell me, he goes, I want you to read the step. And then he said, I want you to read these pages, and we would get together and we would talk about it. And, you know, he walked me through the first step, really simple. You know, I didn't have any problem with unmanageability. I didn't really understand powerlessness. And he said, I don't give a shit. We're going to keep going. You know, You know, because I really didn't think I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't. I wasn't an alcoholic. And he said, okay, well, this is what we're going to do on step two. And he asked me these questions and told me to do these readings. And I said, you know what, I really don't get this stuff, and it's really not me. He goes, that's okay, man. Just do it. You don't have to, you know, because I thought I had to wrap my head around it. You know, I had to understand it. I had to grasp it. And he said, no, you don't. He said, Patrick, you just fake it till you make it, buddy. And that was music to my ears, because I had been faking it my whole life. And I could do that. So I did it. I faked it. And he told me to memorize this prayer. So I did. I memorized the frickin' prayer. And he came, picked me up, took me to his apartment. Said, we're going to do the third step. Walked in his apartment, pulled the coffee table out. Got on his knees in front of his couch, put his hand out, and I immediately knew he wanted me to hold his hand and get on my knees with him. And that was awkward. It was awkward. And but I think I would have been rude to not do it. So I grabbed the guy's hand, got on my knees, and we said this third step prayer together, and I had no idea what I was saying or doing. I just said it, and I did it. He started me working on a fourth step, told me I had to do these columns and what I was going to do. And I'm like, hey, man, what's up with this inventory, these columns? He goes, what do you mean? I said, well, the only thing we're dealing with is resentments, fears, and sex conduct. I said, I think I'm a little more complicated than that. He said, no, you're not. He said, I know you. You're either afraid of somebody, you want to screw them, or you're pissed off at them. Dude had my number. I'm not that complicated. So I did my resentments list, and I did my fears list, and I got to tell you, I did this inventory, and by this time I was in like my fourth month, I think, of sobriety, and I had been listening to you guys for that whole 4 months. I've been listening to what you were telling me, and what you were telling me was, you know what? I didn't do a thorough fourth step, and I got drunk, and I left stuff off, and I kept secrets, and I got drunk, and I mean this was a theme I was hearing. People that had tried to not do this step thoroughly, and they kept, because I had every intention. I had three things that I was not going to put down on that list because they were my sick stuff, and everybody's got sick stuff. I just didn't know it, you know. I knew I had sick stuff, and I didn't want to talk about it. But you guys gave me a gift in meetings by sharing your experience of failure and success, because you know what I was hearing, and I had learned. I'd been able to pick up the fact that you guys that had done the steps and done the work got the gifts, and the ones that kept secrets got drunk again, and I had figured that out. I put it together, and so I sat there and I did my inventory with this guy, and when we got ready to wrap it up, he said, so is there anything else, anything left off? And I said, yeah. And I only did that because I was scared, and I didn't know it, but I wanted to be sober at that time, and I didn't know it. I had no idea, but I got scared, and I said, yeah, there's a few things, and I told him my stuff. And he didn't shame me. He didn't embarrass me. He understood me. He showed me unconditional love and understanding. I got to tell you, what a blessing it was to have that man not judge me or look down on me for my sick stuff. You know, and that's what we do here. And I didn't know that's what was going on here. And I started to get it. You know, I started to get that that the people here loved me and that they understood me, and I was one of you guys, and it sunk in. It finally had sunk in that I was in the right place, and I started to do the steps with willingness and some motivation. I got fired up about it. I got involved with the sponsor, and I got I got on Team Sober. That's what happened. I got on Team Sober. I was, you know, only 1 foot in and 1 foot out, and I was sitting on the edge of my chair. I wasn't sitting all the way in the chair, so I finally put both feet in the program and sat all the way in my chair, and I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I just got to tell you, the I couldn't have planned it on my best day. I couldn't have orchestrated that deal. It was definitely there was a power greater than myself. I've been through a lot in sobriety, and there's a lot of people in this room that's been through a lot with me. They've seen me go through some stuff. Life happens. You don't stick around as long as I have in this program without life happening, because I got to tell you, bad things happen to sober people, you know. And I met my wife. I had moved out of ABC Club into sober living, and my wife was in the women's transitional house, and I really didn't like her much when I met her, because she was a lot like me, and she was a smart ass, and she had a wit, and she was not one to take much crap, and we kind of hit it off as friends, but there was just nothing else there as far as I was concerned. My head was, I was stalking some other honey. And we became friends, and we started talking. We were talking about recovery. I mean, I'm not even kidding. We would sit out in the volleyball court on one of those benches, and we would talk about recovery, and people would have their books there because they were working with their sponsors, and we were fired up about this deal. And I was, man, all of a sudden something happened. We were walking across, just talking, walking across the parking lot of the ABC Club, and they used to have the stereo over by the garage where they had the donos. And this song, this band called Proco Harum was playing. There's this song called Whiter Shade of Pale, and it's kind of a mushy, slow kind of love song. And next thing I know, I'm dancing with her, slow dancing in the frickin' parking lot to this song. This is ridiculous, is what it was. I never slow danced before in my life. The next thing I know, we're having this frickin' moment, you know. I didn't know who Proco Harum was, you know. Anyways, we fell in love, and we started hanging out. I had to ask Danny's permission to take her out on a date. My sponsor made me go to Danny. Imagine that. Okay, anybody that knows Danny, imagine showing up to the ABC Club, going in his office and asking to take one of his girls out on a date. And my sponsor told me I had to do that if I wanted to date her, and she had to have done her 12 steps and all that stuff. And he gave me the green light. And for Danny, the green light was like, yeah, just don't go sucking face on my property, asshole. To Danny Leahy, that was a thumbs up. You know, and Danny knew who I was and what I was about. I was living in sober living. I was sponsoring a bunch of guys there. I was doing everything I could do the deal, you know. And I didn't even have a car, you know. I mean, I was riding the bus to work, and sometimes people were giving me a ride, you know. And we got together, you know. We started dating, and we fell in love, and we moved out. She moved out of women's transitional living, and I moved out of sober living, and we got a place, you know. And then her son came to live with us, and I was an insta dad to a 15-year-old kid, you know, and I couldn't even hardly take care of myself. It was ridiculous, but you know, the principals, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the men in the program helped me, be a sober man through that situation. And they said it wouldn't work. I don't know if anybody said that, but you know, we got married 3 days after my wife's one-year birthday. We got married at the ABC Club. And, it's ridiculous. In the volleyball court, you know. The resident council bought the flowers. And Danny Leahy bought my wedding cake with food stamps. Yeah. Doesn't get any more ghetto than that, let me tell you. And he said, don't tell anybody, asshole. I'll deny it. And, that's where it started for me. I jumped in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've learned a lot from you men and you women. I've always been actively sponsored. I've sponsored guys. I go to meetings, you know, and I have never, my friend Frank, I'm going to go ahead and give you a little juice on this. You know, my friend Frank said something that really resonated with me. He said a long time ago, so I've known this man for a little while, And he said, he goes, I've never come up against you people. And I got to tell you, that's true for me, Frank. I have never come up against you people. I've never come up against the principles of this program or come up against AA or the steps and come up against you and said, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, this isn't right. I've never defied what you guys said. I just have never done that. It's not because I'm scared. It's just that I don't have it in me. I'm not that full of crap, I guess, you know, because I never came up to any of you guys and said, you know what, this ain't working. This ain't right. Something's wrong with this. I learned early on that everything that's about this program is right for me because I never ever fit anywhere in my life like I fit in Alcoholics Anonymous and with you people. And so I've never come up against you people or this program, and I don't see any reason to do it. If anything, I've submitted myself to it 100% to the best of my ability and let you guys guide me through a program of recovery that completely changed my life, and it's made me the man I am today. You know, and for that, I'm really grateful and really proud because I believe I'm the best Patrick I've ever been today. You know, I'm not perfect. I've done this program imperfectly, and I've been an imperfect father, husband, and all that other stuff. But I tell you what, there's nothing that's happened in my life in the last 20 years that Alcoholics Anonymous and you people haven't helped get me through. You know, my dad died of cancer in 2003, and I swear to God, it was the most difficult thing that I've ever been through, and you guys helped me through that. And I walked through it with as much dignity as I could, you know, and you guys told me it's okay. You know what? You're going to be okay. Your dad had 10 years of not worrying about his son. I was 10 years when my dad died. And you know what? That I was so broken when, you know, Danny Leahy told me that at Fellowship Hall one night at a meeting. You know, I was sitting there in tears. And he says, you know, you gave your dad a huge gift, Patrick. 10 years he hasn't had to worry about his son or what's going on with him. He goes, you did that because you did the work to stay sober. It really blows me away. It's incredibly humbling. But, you know, the only thing I can say as I close here, because I believe it's that time, is that, you know, if you're new, there was a few that identified, you know, we're not really, we're not going to take anything from you. Nobody's taking anything from you here. We're just here to give. And the only reason we're here to do that is because there were somebody that did it for us. We know how you feel. We're not going to make rough terms with you if you want this thing. All you got to do is say, I want some help. And you know what? We're going to do it. Okay? We're going to help you out. And you may not understand it. You may not, you know, be able to wrap your head around it. But I'm here to tell you, if a dummy like me can fake it and make it, I'm sure you guys can too. You know, this is it's a magical deal. It's been passed down for a lot of years. And, you know, there's a whole room full of people here, you know, and they say there's a wrench for every nut in this program. And it's true. You know, I believe that God, you know, directs us right where we're supposed to be, you know, so ask for some help if you're new. You know, you don't have to want this thing to get it. And, you know, I hope you do get it because it's completely changed my life. And for that, I'm grateful. So thank you.